This episode of the Last Drinks podcast is sponsored by Zecca Skin. Zecca Skin specializes in high-quality men's skincare products that not only benefit the health of your skin, but also support men's mental health. Use discount code LASTDRINKS25 at checkout to get 25% off all Zecca Skin products. And if you wish to support the show, you can now donate via Buy Me A Coffee. That's www.buymeacoffee.com/lastdrinks. All donations will go to keeping the show running and thriving. We greatly appreciate all the support we've received from our fans and followers. Now sit back and relax, and we hope you enjoy this episode of the Last Drinks podcast.
Well, isn't that the way? You're just like, yeah, just fine. It's fine.
Yeah, you've got to like pump the talent up.
Yeah, well, yeah. Looks fabulous. It's fabulous, Faye.
Yes, fabulous
Faye
like
is here. Fantastic, fabulous, fantabulous.
Oh, fantabulous, I can do it the wrong way.
Well, as we know, this is the Last Drinks podcast. I'm Will Hitchens, and my guest today is obviously the fantastic, fantabulous, fabulous Faye Lawrence.
Hello.
Hello. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Now, you're a grey area drinking coach.
Yep.
You're a psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
You co-authored a book, Voices of Impact.
Correct.
TEDx speaker.
Yeah.
And a founder of Untoxicated.
Yeah.
Australia's largest alcohol-free social tribe community.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there. There's a lot of accolades.
It makes me sound much better than I actually am.
She's also very humble and modest about her achievements. But yeah, so you've had, I guess, a past history with using alcohol. How long have you been without alcohol?
I stopped in late 2017.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was November 2017.
So it's like, yeah, we're coming into year six now.
It's coming up 6 years. Yeah. It's hard to believe.
Because yeah, do you think of like a time? Yeah, the time before that, where you're probably in the thick of it thinking you would never give it up at all?
Well, I was trying for a long time on and off to make changes to my relationship with alcohol. And really, for me, it needed to get to a point where I just couldn't deny it anymore.
Mm.
You know, like I just wasn't willing. I was so wedded to the alcohol that the thought of not having it was just unimaginable to me. And so I resisted any kind of real changes, I guess, even though the first time I actually accessed support for my alcohol consumption was in 2001 and I stopped in 2017. So that's the trajectory, isn't it, for a lot of people?
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be like a lot of people on the back of an incident, something that's happened, and then I'd go, Christ, I really need to sort this out. This isn't the sort of person that I want to be.
Mm.
So, you know, I might go to an AA meeting, or I might go and, you know, talk to a counsellor, or I went on medication a number of times, like naltrexone, Campril.
Mm.
I wasn't ready.
Mm.
You're just not ready till you're ready.
Yeah, yeah. That's a common occurrence for a lot of us, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess take us back to how did your introduction to alcohol, what was your introduction to alcohol and how did the journey progress from there?
You know, like a lot of people, I grew up in a pretty boozy environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the culture in the UK,
mm-hmm.
as I'm sure it was in Australia.
Yeah.
So it was very common for, you know, all sorts of everything, really, the family environment, the social environment, the celebration, the reward, the commiseration, the, you know, all of it. And it just wasn't, you know, there was also those sort of commonly held narratives in the family about, you know, we don't trust people that don't drink. And my grandparents they'd lived the expat life for a while overseas.
Yeah.
And my granddad brewed his own beer and all that sort of stuff. And we just, you know, like we'd get together for the Sunday lunches and everyone would get pissed. And that was just what everyone did back then. And so I think also I grew up in quite a liberal family. Like my parents were hippies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up with fairly strong elements of drugs and alcohol being kind of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't till about, I was about 10 or 11, I think it was, probably 10, that I realised that, like, smoking pot was actually illegal.
Yeah.
Because we used to grow it in the back garden.
Oh, okay.
You know, we'd have the plants.
Mm.
So we, us four kids, all experimented pretty early with a lot of stuff. And I think also I did have quite an unconventional, in many respects, upbringing. Mm. And as part of that, it was exposure to a bit of adversity.
Mm.
And so I think it was just hand in glove.
Mm.
As soon as the alcohol, I was able to access it, it was like, brilliant. I can switch this off.
Mm.
I can not have to deal with the feelings. I found a way to survive that just was like, I was like a magnet.
Mm.
And I loved it.
Yeah. So it sounds like a moment of instant connection.
Yeah, I don't know if it's instant connection or instant disconnection.
That's one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instant disconnection, which is actually really what I wanted, because I didn't want to be me.
Mm.
I didn't want to experience all the things that I was experiencing, like the level of anxiety of just being in my skin, in my life. And thinking that, you know, and as you get older, you realise that this is bullshit, but, like, I'm the only one feeling this way.
Mm.
And everyone else has got it together, and everyone else is confident, and everyone else, you know, and they're just successful, and they're this and they're that. And I think it just, the alcohol really just helped me stay afloat when I felt so bad about myself. But of course it perpetuates that, doesn't it? Because you're constantly on this treadmill then of shame, regret, remorse, self-flagellation. So you get some temporary respite from it, but, you know, it's ultimately going to exacerbate those negative feelings that you have about yourself. So that really was my experience from quite a young age. But initially, I would say probably I went more, you know, I did the rave scene when I was quite young back in the UK, which I absolutely loved. So I did a lot of drugs as well. And I had another stint back at that in my early 40s.
What, the raves or the drugs?
Both.
Both, yeah.
But with the drugs, I could always take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
But with the alcohol, that was just my kryptonite.
Mm. Yeah, and I think if you're feeling a certain way that you, like you said, you feel guilt and shame about what you're experiencing, because maybe you think you're in conflict of, well, I shouldn't be feeling this way, but yet I am feeling this way, and I don't want to express this to other people because how are they going to perceive me? And you just keep it to yourself, and then you've got this thing that you just take a swig of, and then, oh, peace
just
now.
Makes everything okay.
Mm. Like, well, that's easy to grasp onto.
Yeah.
And then just, all right, well, this is the solution to that. And I just keep tapping away at that.
Yeah. But I think also that I experienced such debilitating levels of anxiety from quite a young age that I also didn't understand that it was a way to manage, to self-medicate.
Yeah. So just like all the other dramas of life, that was the go-to.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that's just continued on through formative years into becoming a young adult. That's, I guess, is that just the way it went for you?
I think as well, like, I'd really firmed up this identity as the party animal, the fun time, you know, person, the person who was the extrovert, which I am naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, the alcohol just went hand in hand with that. And I loved it. I loved it in many respects. Like, let's see how far we can push it.
Yeah.
Let's see how late we can stay out, how long the party can go for, how fucked up we can get.
Mm.
And I've always been quite rebellious as well. I'm sort of anti-authoritarian, and I've got this inner rebel, which is like, you can't tell me what to do. I'm going to, you know, which is like, yeah, okay, that's fine when you're in your teens. When you're in your early 40s, maybe not so maybe not so much.
Yeah.
But it was just the sense of that carefree freedom that you have when you're out in those moments, or even if you're at home in those moments, you can put down your responsibility for a bit. I mean, I became a parent at quite a young age, at 22, just before my 23rd birthday. And so, you know, there was all that as well. So it was just respite from my life and from myself. Really, that's what I was looking back retrospectively. That's what I was, the main thing that I was getting out of it.
So you managed to have the separate lives. So you have like the normal life, and then you have the rebellious anti-authority party life over here, and you could keep those two separate.
No, I don't think they were necessarily entirely separate, because I was very, throughout most of it, I was still high functioning. So, you know, I mean, I graduated psychology, a psych degree, a month after getting sober. So I was still managing to work full time, study, and parent when the kids were smaller, certainly, and all of these things, and keep all the balls juggling. But I was doing it while smashing the booze and or drugs when that was in and out of my life. So I think it's really, really hard. This is why the grey area stuff is quite useful, because we have this sort of either or narrative. You're either an alcoholic or you're fine, just like everybody else. And the reality is there's a lot of people like me who are high functioning, who's still managing to do everyday life and often do it quite okay.
Yeah.
But you're constantly at night, basically, well, you're in this internal battle with yourself just constantly. So you know, I remember I was working in like quite a high profile corporate gig, and this was like my dream job, you know, and every night I was getting smashed with the guy that I was dating at the time, who was a complete psychopath. And then at lunchtime, I mean, this was every night.
Yeah.
And then at lunchtime, I'd be so hungover that I'd go to his place, because I worked in the city. He lived just down the road. I'd go to his place, have a couple of glasses of wine, have a lie down for half an hour, and then go back to work. And that was just normal.
Yeah, like that's just what you did.
That's just what you did. And then I might go out after work with friends, and then, you know, smash five bottles with them, and then do the same thing the next day.
Yeah.
And it was just, yeah, isn't this fun? And look, there absolutely were fun bits, but I was trapped, because I didn't want to keep doing this, but I just didn't know any real way of not doing it because it's what I'd always known. And also, I just couldn't imagine the thought of not having alcohol in my life at all. And yeah, and that was just so confronting to me. And so really it got to the stage where I had to accept that I'd just lost control. I just lost control by the end.
Yeah. Was that just a progressional thing, as it sometimes goes, or does it come crashing down with a big, big catastrophic event? How did it play out to get to that point?
I think it had been a long time coming. I'd basically been in a relationship with this guy. He was also a heavy drinker, and that had ended. I'd moved into a place by myself, so the kids were no longer at home, so I didn't have anyone seeing what I was doing. I was self-employed, so I didn't need to go out to work. So really I could hide. You know, I had no accountability. There were no outside factors. No one could see what I was doing. And so that's when, and I was also in a real period of distress, you know, like I was really, things had built up that I just couldn't push down anymore. And that was when it had already been progressively getting worse and worse and worse. But by that stage, I had started day drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I was waking up in the morning, and I was either smashing what was left from the night before where I passed out, or Valium, or, you know, sometimes I'd like wake up and there'd be some, I don't know, some wine left next to the bed, and I'd just be like lying there crying, looking, staring at the wall with my wine. Just, yeah. And, you know, but you get really sneaky or tricky about the way that you're drinking, don't you? So I was like alternating bottle shops.
Yeah.
So I'd go to three different bottle shops during the day.
Yeah.
And I'd convince myself, like, they didn't know that, you know. but each time, this is the madness of it all, each time I'd go, I'd only buy one bottle or six beers or something like that, because I'd be like, nope, that's it, that's all you're having. Even though I knew it played out the same way every single day. Mm. It was the same.
Mm.
And... yeah, I was really just trying to limit, but I couldn't.
Mm.
I couldn't. And so, by then there was no enjoyment, reward. It didn't help with the anxiety. It didn't help push my emotions down anymore. There was no fun in it. Mm. Like, I was drinking at home by myself a lot. If I went out, I literally would only remember the first 30 minutes to the half an hour. Then I'd be so shit-faced that, you know, I wouldn't remember how the not remembering how I got home had been going on for probably about 20 years, to be honest.
Yeah.
But any illusion that I had held about this night being different...
Mm.
Was out the window. I knew that was bullshit, even to myself.
Mm.
And I knew that when I went out, I would have no idea how I got home. I would have no idea where I'd been. I probably would have very little idea of who I'd been with. Mm. You know, past that first 30 to 60 minutes.
Mm.
And I really was starting to get that depressed, because I felt so trapped in this cycle that I was starting to lose the will to live.
Yeah.
Which sounds dramatic and, oh, but I was.
Mm.
And I remember there was quite close to the end, I was sitting on my deck smoking and drinking, and the wine was there, and I didn't even want it, but I just couldn't. I couldn't stop.
Yeah,
and that's when I went, I've got to do something. I need help. I can't do this by myself.
Mm.
And then that's when I went into, inpatient detox.
Mm. Yeah, it's a tough thing. Yeah, you're getting into that space. And yeah, like, I commend you for sharing, being open about that, because, yeah, it can be a difficult thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, you can just be, so stuck in it, and especially because I resonate with a lot of it with, especially waking up every day, after you've had a big night, you wake up every day, it's just like, I'm not doing this again.
Mm.
I can't do this again. Or it's just like, I'm never drinking again.
Mm.
By the afternoon, by the next hour, whichever it is, you're drinking again, and then you're just losing trust within yourself. Because you said you weren't going to, but you don't have the strength to just, or the power within yourself to keep your word, because you're powerless over this thing that's got a hold over you.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about it, I guess, because I eventually asked for help and then wound up in rehab because I asked for mum for help, and I kind of saw it as like, I had this, if I was in like, when I was drinking, if I was in like a madhouse, and then there's like a window in the corner, and then the window opened, and it's just like, all right, you can go out there if you want. It's dark. You don't know what's out there.
Mm.
But there's your opportunity to go out. And then that was me sending my message, like, all right, I'm going to go out. Because other times it's like, nah, don't want to go out yet. Mm. Shut the door. Mm. And like you said before, you're not ready until you're ready.
Yeah.
And I guess it sounds like, like that was your moment. And so, you end up in inpatient detox. What was that like?
Ooh. This is what I wrote about in the book chapter. So basically, because I went to inpatient detox and it was part of the public hospital system, so basically I presented an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they said to me was the best thing to do. So I did that, and they couldn't get me in. There's only 16 beds in the whole of Queensland for drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
So I had 10 days before they could get me in. So, of course, I went and got... I was like, brilliant.
10 more days.
10 more days. Even though I was in that state that I was, but I just didn't have to say the final goodbye just yet. Mm. You know, I'd bought myself some more time. But within that time, I ended back up in emergency because I was in such a state again. My eldest daughter took me, and... when I finally went, did go in, basically, well, I was over the limit when I rocked up, and I didn't realise that they had to, they breathalyse you. I didn't realise you had to be under the limit anyway. The guy said to me, just wait here for an hour or whatever. But yeah, so I went in, everyone there is, it was a real mix. It was such an eye-opener for me because there were people... There was a teacher, there was a policewoman, there was people who'd been court ordered, there was a guy who was a bikie, there was, you know, there was, even though there were only 16 beds, there was quite a, you know, an array, a colourful array of characters. And, I mean, it was very humbling because it's like we're all here for the same reason. This transcends any kind of socioeconomic anything.
Yeah.
Like, we are all here because we are all addicted to something and we can't do it ourselves.
Yeah.
And it was a really... Look, it was difficult. It was difficult, but I was just determined there and then. I was like, I'm never coming back here again.
Yeah.
I'm never coming back here again. So for me, it was motivating in many ways because it just signified like how out of control things got for me. And I just went, nah, this is where the rebel came out. And the rebel went, nah, I don't accept this.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I'd been studying psych and I saw the stats up on the other side of the ward. They were sort of up on one of the pin boards and it showed the rates of, you know, the return, the success rates, I guess, for want of a better word, and the amount of times people come back. Because most people, a lot of people in there were like four or five times
they'd been. I had that with when I was in rehab. I met a lot of return customers. And
yeah. And I was just the stubborn rebel in me was just like, I'm not going to be one of these repeat people. I'm just not gonna. So I used that to motivate me, and that was it. I never drank again.
So it worked.
Yeah. I was just determined that I needed to completely change my mindset. I needed to just do whatever it took. But also, I think for me, I'd scared myself.
Yeah.
I'd scared myself with how bad things have become. And I also, you know, I grew up with a number of alcoholic family members.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that. I didn't want that.
Yeah.
I'd let it go long enough.
To get to that point where it's just like, yep, this is it. Like for me, like hearing, like seeing the statistics of, it's a high percentage of people that who leave treatment will relapse within like 12 months. I mean, I've seen anywhere from like 5 to 15% of people stay sober the rest of their lives after treatment. And I guess like for myself, I was sober for 2 years, then I fell off the wagon. But, you know, I'm sober again today. And I credit that to, I guess, the stuff that, I guess, the work that I didn't do in that first 2 years that I guess I revisited in my next run, this current run, hopefully the last one. Like, I don't have any interest in going back out again.
What work was that? Do you mind me asking?
I had an issue, I guess, because in the first 2 years it was socializing around people who were drinking or just being around it. Like, I just thought, well, it's... I thought it was going to be too challenging and too difficult. And it probably would have been at one point, like early stages. So I just avoided it for I mostly interacted with my parents like once a week for like 2 years, and then had some interactions with a couple of friends at the time. But a lot of my friendships sort of dissipated because, I guess because those friends were still in that type of environment that I was looking to, well, for the benefit of me, not be a part of anymore. So it stemmed back, from like high school, like peer pressure. That's how I ended up drinking. So I had always had this fear that I was going to be offered a drink and I don't drink, but then they just keep persistent, just have a drink, just have a drink, and I wouldn't be able to say no. So that when I was overseas and I went to London, and there was all these different sort of, you know, triggers that I had that just sort of led to me to just think I was overly like anxious that it was going to happen. So then I just thought, and I convinced myself, well, if it's going to happen, you may as well just do it yourself. And then that's when I just decided to drink again, and then off we go for another 6 months doing that, all that. And
did it happen quite quickly? Like, did you start off going, oh, I'm just going to moderate?
Well, I mean, I had to be honest with myself. There was never really, I never really had in my mind to moderate, because never saw the point. It was always just a drink. I mean, there might have been times I might not have had as much one night. I mean, even the first night I drank, like I woke up the next day and nothing happened, and I was like, oh, maybe it's different this time.
Adults.
Yeah. But then, you know, within like a couple of weeks, just lots of shit started happening again. And it was just, being stuck on that, and then eventually stopping again. And I resonate again with not wanting to go back to rehab, because that was, because when I came back, like I didn't tell anyone back here, like anyone, like my family, a few friends I talked to, no one knew. So I just kept this to myself that I was going through this, because, it's a shame. And if I was to go, come back to my parents, and it was just like, you know, I failed. And it wasn't until, I stopped drinking February 1st, 2020. Month later, the world ended. So then we were at home anyway.
Oh, my God, what a time to give up.
Yeah.
Was that helpful, though? Or was it a hindrance or a help?
For me, like, it was the environment that I was in. So I was renting a room in the suburbs with a woman in her 70s, a retiree. She rented out rooms in her house. And then I was living with a 60-year-old grandmother, and then like a single dad in his mid-40s. So think of that dynamic. It was, you know, it was certainly very different. And, you know, I'd sit out, I guess she was my landlady, and she'd be sitting there drinking red wine every night. And it's like, are you not triggered by drinking here? And I was just like, this doesn't appeal to me at all.
Yeah.
So to be, and I ended up, because that was only going to be temporary, but it ended up living there for the year. And then, so I had a year up, and then that's when I told my parents, and then they were just like, oh, well, it's good that you sorted it out. We kind of had a feeling something was going on, because, I mean, like, I was getting heavier, and like my dad said, oh, we thought something was going on because you got fat in the face. So it wasn't something I could hide. But then when I started going out and getting uncomfortable around people who were drinking and just dealing with it, and then getting to the place where it's just like, I don't need it anymore, and then realizing, well, I don't need to meet people in bars and clubs anymore. There's other ways you can meet people as well. So it's just about realizing, well, potentially for me, it's like, well, I avoided it for 2 years and I still drank. So what if I do the opposite and go in knee deep and get uncomfortable with it? You'll come out the other side and then go, oh, I don't like being around drunk people. It's just like, that's fine. You can find people who aren't drinking. It's just like, then go do that.
I think, though, there can be almost, and I see this with people that I work with, there's almost like this whole desire to prove that you haven't changed and you're still as fun, and you're going to go out to the same old environments and do the same old things. I liken it a little bit to like when people have kids and they're like, well, it's not going to change us. We're still going to go backpacking around the world. We're just going to have the kid on the back, you know, like it's just this whole thing. No, actually, no, your life is going to change quite a bit. But I think with that resistance, which a lot of people experience. And I don't know if I did. I think I did a bit at the beginning to like, oh, well, I'm still going to go out and do all the things. And then quickly realizing that actually I'm not enjoying this.
Yeah.
Like, this is boring. Like, it's fine to pop along, get, you know, so it's giving yourself permission to not do the things that you did before necessarily. Do things in a different way, like you're saying.
Yeah. Well, you're like redefining what you find fun, really. Yeah. And yeah, like if you've been surrounded by people and you've defined fun in the way of hanging around drinking together and you stop drinking and then you start to explore, well, what do I find, what else can I find fun? And then you find other areas that are all moving away from that environment. Because yeah, like, yeah, people are like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to quit drinking, but nothing else is going to change. It's actually, it does, like, a lot changes if you're willing to, yeah, like, step into it.
I think that's if you're someone who's been, you know, struggling with this for a while. I think if you're someone who's giving up for, like, health reasons or something, it's probably less of an issue. But if you're like we were, then, and the drinking is such an intrinsic part of your social life and those environments that you flock to, then it's just too much to be able to continue exposing yourself to that, I think. But also it's just not enjoyable. You're like, oh my god, it's the same story over and over again. Like, I used to spend hours hours of my life doing this, and like, it's fucking pointless. Like, there's no, literally no point to it. You can't remember it anyway.
Yeah, that's it. And because you have heightened levels of dopamine and happy chemicals in you, you think you're having the best time of your life and you're having these great conversations. It's so in-depth and meaningful. You have all these business ideas. You tell your mate you love him for the first time and then it all just goes the next time you wake up in the morning. And then it's just like, what was the point?
Absolutely. So, I mean, that is not how I want to spend my time anymore.
And so, yeah, like finishing detox, giving alcohol the flick, you then, I guess, have to then face the stuff that you were masking with the alcohol, I guess, from your childhood with all the anxiety and stuff. And you've actually mentioned that you were diagnosed late ADHD. As well. Did you want to go into that?
Sure. So the mental health stuff's been in the mix for, you know, forever really. And that was something that I identified really young, even as a child. But I actually proactively was starting to do things to try and address anxiety, panic attacks and all that sort of stuff from, you know, really my early 20s. But with the ADHD in particular, what happened after I stopped drinking was I was probably about 2 or 3 years in and I kept hearing everybody else saying about how much calmer they are, how their anxiety's a lot less. And I was thinking, there's something not right here. Like, my body always feels tense. I always feel like there's a motor going, like I could never get this place of relaxation or calmness or anything like that that other people could get, and my brain was always just ping 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 ping. You know, and I do have a track record as well of not needing a lot of variety, shall we say. That's the positive but you know, not being in jobs for a long time, so I think like 2.5 years is the longest I've ever been in a job. You know, relationships as well have not been necessarily, you know, long term. And I actually had been to go and see a psychiatrist about potential ADHD before I stopped drinking, and he said, oh no, look, it's trauma, blah, off you go. And once I'd taken the alcohol out of the piece, though, I could see that something wasn't right. And I just went to explore the diagnosis sort of on an off chance having had the previous experience. And yeah, it came back that I've got the combined type, which is both the inattentive and the hyperactive, and I'm sort of at the pointy end of presentation, shall we say. So that was another reason that it just made real sense to me, because there's a strong link between addiction and ADHD, because of the neurotransmitters that we're deficient in are the ones, the dopamine.
Yeah.
And the dopamine and the noradrenaline. So lots and lots of people who have ADHD do experience addiction of some kind, whether that's drugs, alcohol, sex, shopping, food is another big one. Gambling is another huge one. And we are simply utilizing the addiction. Well, there's a number of reasons that we're dopamine seeking, but also we're trying to get some respite from being in these bodies and being in these heads. And the addiction is serving a purpose to get our dopamine levels up to a level where everybody else's, their baseline is.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have a narrative when you have ADHD, which is very commonly experienced by people, which is around failure, because you can see other people adulting, doing all the things, and you're like, fuck, it takes me 2 hours to get out the door. I can't find my keys. I can't, like today, coming here, I was...
Distressed,
I'm
out.
Like, honestly, it's back. It's just like, oh God, and I've forgotten that. And oh, you know, it's just you're constantly trying to operate in a neurotypical world, so you get this sense that you don't quite fit, and that you are you do things differently to the norm, and we turn that inwards and we kind of go, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And so that's another reason that people, you know, are driven towards addiction. So, yeah, that was a big piece of the puzzle for me, and really helped me understand why things panned out the way they did. It was just like a sort of smorgasbord of childhood trauma, ADHD, and they are linked.
Yeah.
Anxiety, you know, it was... Yeah, all this stuff. So, yeah.
I mean, that would that have come from you studying psychology and just looking at some of these, I guess, behaviors and thinking maybe some of this stuff could relate to what I'm experiencing, or is it just completely different? Like, it was just, there might be, again, opinions from other doctors.
I thought for a long time that it was probably more complex PTSD, to be honest. So I have... you know, I've done study in counselling, psychology and coaching, but I've also got a lot of lived experience with these types of things in my own life, and I've been interested in human behaviour and why we do what we do for, you know, since I was a teenager, essentially. And I've always found it incredibly fascinating. But interestingly, you know, neurodiversity is often... spread throughout families, and so you are often growing up in an environment where all, if not the majority of you, are neurodivergent, and you're not recognizing the woods for the trees, because why would you, because you're all like it.
Yeah.
And then retrospectively I was able to kind of go, yes, okay, I can see now, like, the whole family, a lot of us are neurodivergent. And interestingly enough, since I got my diagnosis, a significant proportion of my friends have also been diagnosed.
So it's contagious, isn't it?
It is. But a lot of those people have experienced addiction as well.
Yeah, that gets around a bit as well, the old addiction behaviours too, as we know.
Yeah. So birds of a feather flock together. So I, you know, really hadn't picked it until I took the alcohol out of the mix.
So yeah, you were able to, I guess, see it with a clearer picture of what was going on.
Yeah.
And that's usually, I mean, that's what I've been recommending to people not, I guess, in regards with things like that, but just for your life in general, if you need shit to sort out, or just you're coming to a point, it's like, fuck, a lot of my life I'm not too sure about. Just like, just take the booze out, even if you don't think you have a problem, like for a brief period, and then you can think with a clear head and not be hung over all the time, and start picking away at what things you want to change with your life for the better.
It's challenging though, isn't it? Because I think when there are mental health things in the mix, and or significant stuff that's buried, it means you've got to face it.
Yeah.
So like, you're not only giving up the booze, which in itself, you know, is quite challenging for a lot of us, you're then going, surprise! Yeah. Here's all this other shit to deal with.
Yeah. You give up you give up the booze, that which makes you feel great temporarily, and now we want you to deal with all this shit
that you've been drinking, so you didn't have to deal with it. Yeah.
And it's going to be confronting, and you might be put off by it and scared, and like tense up about it. But
yeah, did you find that?
I mean, I guess it's, I mean, for me, the decision to go back to drinking was just like, okay, well, that's taken off the table. So it's just, all right, you know, we're just going to have to keep pushing forward through it. And just, because I guess there's still at times I'm still dealing with stuff. And I mean, like we've chatted with people, because I guess with Mitch and I, I'd kind of expand upon, okay, well, if we feel we're in a position where we've built a foundation where we're sober, alcohol-free, what do you want to define yourselves now? Well, what's the next thing? And it's like, well, what was the shit underneath that you hadn't dealt with? And then, so then we had people on, like we chatted before, mentioned Lewis Huckstep. He was talking about healing your traumas and wounds. And my challenge was like, well, if I got blackout drunk a lot, I don't remember a lot of things. So trying to remember traumas and heal from things that I don't remember was quite a confusing, challenging thing. And then thinking, well, because like I'd think if it was like from childhood, it's like, well, my childhood was fine. But I don't know if, you know, all this insignificant thing that I would think is, oh, no, that's a trauma. I was like, is it? Really?
Well, there's big T trauma and little T trauma.
Because I would always have a like comparison of just like, oh, you know, well, I didn't have a violent childhood. I didn't have a chaotic childhood. I didn't have anything like that. So it's just like, so mine must have been fine. But then there's always the point to point out that like how traumatic your trauma is. Like even if you've got someone who's had something really bad, like what you think is worse, like the trauma is still trauma. There's no like, oh, this is way more traumatic. It depends on how it feels within the person who's experiencing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You've gone through exploring the work for yourself, and then you enter, I guess you already were studying psychology, but then you've also gone into grey area drink coaching to help others. And this was something that I hadn't heard of this term until we interviewed a fellow Brit expat, Sarah Rusbach. I think it was the end of last year.
Oh, yeah.
She gave us the lowdown on what that meant.
Yeah.
But I guess if there's new listeners tuning in, can you define what grey area drinking is, or what is it? What is it to you?
I think it is really what I was talking about earlier, which is that it's the space between someone who can kind of take it or leave it, or just drinks occasionally, and someone who's a real problem drinker. Yeah. So if you looked in the DSM, which is what psychologists and psychiatrists use to diagnose, you know, you've got mild, moderate and severe alcohol use disorder. It's probably the mild and moderate. But bearing in mind the recommended guidelines for alcohol consumption is no more than 10 drinks a week. To my mom, that's like amateur.
That was a couple of hours.
Yeah, exactly. Big time. So it's really if you find yourself drinking more than you would like often, but you might do stints like Dry July or Feb Fast and kind of go, yeah, high five to me, I can do this. So you might have periods off, but you constantly find yourself going back to drinking and then essentially you know, like I say, drinking more than you would like when you do drink. So you might be someone that doesn't drink every day. But for me personally, I think the better barometer is, are you showing up in your life as the person you want to be?
Yeah.
Is alcohol contributing to that in a positive way or a negative way? How do you feel about yourself after you've been drinking?
Yeah.
And because I think people who don't have a problem with drinking don't question whether they've got a problem with drinking.
Yeah.
Like, I don't question whether I've got a problem with gambling. I might gamble once a year.
Yeah.
I can take it or leave it. That's not to put judgment on people that have a problem with gambling, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I wouldn't even question that. Why would I? Because I don't have a problem with gambling. So if you're questioning, that's probably a pretty good indication. And I think it's that little knowing inside of yourself where you really do know whether this is an issue for you, I mean, whether it's a small issue or a big issue, and it's listening to that. Because this thing has a natural progression.
It does, yeah. Because, like Sarah talked about it, just being like on a scale of 1 to 10 and that you're only heading in one direction. It's not that you're going to like get here and then go back. You might, I don't know, you might stop, but then because... I guess like the neuro pathways that you build, like I still probably have them. Like if I was to fall off the wagon, it would be, oh, well, you drank before this heavy amount, so you'll just go back and do that again, which, I mean, for myself, you know, could cause drama. You know, that could be a deadly mix because, you know, your body's not used to, it got used to the abuse before, but now it's, you know, rebuild itself.
Fresh as a daisy now.
And especially like you're questioning it, and it doesn't necessarily, because I think the stigma around the word alcoholic, like I guess I would have defined myself as an alcoholic at one point because I did have that physical dependence. Like there was like I would be itching for it. I, you know, my life kind of revolved around it. So because I think like a common for a lot of people would be like, oh well, I'm fine during the week, I don't touch it during the week. But then they just smash it really hard on the weekend. And it's kind of like, well, those 10 standard drinks a week have, you know, been polished off on that Saturday night. So,
like you say, easy.
And so, like, you have, when you have clients reach out and inquire to work with you, you start working with getting them to, you do the steps to try and cater off drinking, or do you go straight through, all right, well, what are the reasons for why you are drinking?
It just, look, I don't have a cookie cutter approach at all. I basically work with people where they're at. I find out where they want to go first and what's stopping them from getting there. So it just depends on the client, because I couch myself as a coach. Coaching is quite different to, say, counselling or psychotherapy. You're not generally delving into any depth. You're working with the person where they are now, where they want to go. Okay, how do we get you there? What are the strategies we give? What, you know, what's the mindset piece? What's the payoff for you? What purpose is alcohol solving? And then how can we shift these things? But with invariably, you know, you do generally, whether I'm working with people in a coaching capacity or a counselling capacity, you're going to start getting a bit deeper if there's appetite for that. And you know, often people have grown up with parents who are an alcoholic. So it just it depends on the presentation of the client. And not everyone's ready to give up. So for me, it's more around, okay, well, let's meet you where you are in the stages of change. And let's explore that without judgment, because the more we kind of judge ourselves and the more we chastise ourselves and beat ourselves up, the more we're going to go straight back into the arms of booze.
I think when we chatted with Sarah, she mentioned that she'd get people she'd work with who would just, I just want to moderate my drinking.
That's all the time. Yeah.
And she jokingly asked them, like, when was the last time you were able to do that? And they couldn't think of a time. And she's just like, well, I'm not a bloody magician.
Yeah.
Just hearing, oh, I just want to drink like a gentleman. I just want to drink like a lady. And it's...
Well, the definition of insanity, as we know, is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah.
But such is the illusion of, you know, the denial that we keep ourselves in, because the thought of letting go and of forever is a lot.
Mm.
I mean, you know, and this is where I show compassion to my clients, because if someone said to me, you can never drink coffee again, I'd be like, what the? Mm. No, what? Like, to me, you know, even when you know something isn't necessarily serving you, to say that you've actually got to take this out completely is a big thing.
Mm.
Same as if someone said to me, you can never eat chocolate again,
mm.
you know? But would I say those things are actively harming me in my life? No, but I'd really resist having to give anything up forever,
mm.
unless I had to.
And that's why, I guess, in recovery, they encouraged... It was actually one of the things that I remember hearing in an AA meeting, which was this guy just said he didn't have a drink today. And that kind of resonated with me, and I just stuck with that. It's just because then it's like, oh, well, I just don't drink today.
It's the one day at a time thing.
One day at a time, keeping it simple. Because, yeah, to put, especially if they've come into you, oh, I think I have an issue with drinking. All right, you can't drink ever again. That just like, oh, what? Really? Oh, no, that's nerve-wracking, yeah, to just give something up straight away. Because you only live in today. So the thought of giving it up forever, there's no need to think of it that way. Because, you know, who knows what will happen.
Exactly.
I guess over time, for myself, they got a point where I'm like, oh, well, I don't care if I never drink it again because I know I'm better off without it. But even when I went into rehab, I had the thought, like, I'll give this a year. Like, you know, even I was in the as low as a point as it could be. It's like, oh, in a year, I'll probably be back on it. Like, it turned out it was 2 years. So
there you go. Still there you 2 years.
And so do you work with men and women?
I do, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I work with men and women. It's interesting. It's been really eye-opening, actually, to work with men.
Mm-hmm.
So with Untoxicated, we've made a real effort to try and have options for men, because in the sobriety space or alcohol-free space, there's a lot for women.
Mm.
It's a lot harder for, I believe, there's fewer avenues for men.
Yeah.
Is what I've seen. You know, even like if you look at the majority of the podcasts, the programs, the this, the that, they're mainly, I think, skewed towards women. So, you know, one of my best mates hosts up in Brisbane, or two of my best mates actually are guys, and they host events, and we really try and do things that are, you know, catering or inclusive of men, like targeted to men. So we do camping, we do bike, you know, mountain biking, we do things like that, because I think, and this is what I notice in my coaching practice as well, is that it's men really struggle with any display of weakness, perceived weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found with my coaching clients, which has been a revelation to me in many respects, is that men are just as sensitive as women.
Mm-hmm.
And they care actually a lot about their relationships. They care about their relationships with their partners and their kids. Mm. And often that is the motivation for them to want to make the changes. But it's hard for them to access support because it conveys weakness.
Mm.
And, you know, this might be in very simplistic terms, and that's why I think coaching is a bit of a softer landing for them, or easier to reach for, because coaching has got that whole sense of it's not coming from a deficit's perspective, whereas right. maybe something like counselling, for example, kind of like you're coming because there's something wrong with you.
Mm.
Coaching is more like, I'm going to see my personal trainer. My personal trainer's going to like devise a plan for me. Mm. And going back to what you were saying a minute ago, yes, that is exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to help devise a plan for you, but I can't go to the gym for you.
Mm.
I can't go and do the exercise for you.
Yeah.
And that's regardless, men or women, with that side of things. So Yeah, I really enjoy working with male clients, and it's great to see so many more opportunities sort of presenting for men like this podcast. Yeah. Because I think it's so important that we have those voices and representations and options available for guys.
Mm. Yeah, because I remember even when our first chats with Justine Whitchurch, she mentioned similar things. She'd get lots of men reach out to her. That weren't as comfortable expressing. I mean, I guess they were reaching out to her with their issues, I guess, with alcohol that they probably weren't comfortable sharing with perhaps their intimate partner.
Yeah.
It's
so surprising to me. That as well has been a real revelation.
Because men displaying weakness can be quite a prevalent thing. We have to be these strong, stoic people that, we got to have a handle on everything. And I felt that for a long time, especially when I was in the thick of it. I mean, why I didn't get help for a long time was because of that. It was because, well, you're a man, you're supposed to handle your shit.
Mm.
Later to learn when I eventually did get help, I needed someone else to fucking come in and then just start to get the ball rolling. You know, obviously then once I got taken out of the environment, put in rehab and then started, all right, well, let's start doing the work. Then that's when I start doing the work. I mean, I can attest to reaching out for help makes a drastic difference for sure. I mean, it's brought me to sitting here today. Just one text message to Mum, I need help.
But it's so hard, isn't it? I identify with a lot of masculine traits myself. I do think I'm in my masculine quite a lot. And that, I think, is part of why I was so determined not to go back to detox, because I felt like such a failure for needing help.
Yeah.
Outside of, going to see a psych or something like that, needing a stronger intervention, I was like, but I've always been the strong one, but I was the eldest growing up and I looked after everyone else and I was, and I've studied psych and da-da-da-da-da. And then to admit that I couldn't do it by myself was really fucking mortifying, actually. Yeah. Really mortifying and freeing as well.
Yeah, you can finally let go of it.
Oh, finally, to be able to let go and just go, I give up. I actually just give up. I can't. The struggle is, I've got to lay down the tools. This is it. Please, somebody just take over the reins of my fucking life.
Yeah, it's just that moment of surrender with it. And I guess, with a lot of things in life, as humans, we're social beings, we're meant to be, we're not designed for the most part to be on our own. I guess as much as some of these, you get Hollywood movies and TV shows of archetypes of just these lone wolf characters that we kind of fetishize and romanticize, but for a lot of it, we do need each other. We do need to help each other out, and especially even with regards to this space, finding people, especially reaching out to people like yourself who've been there, there's that relatability where they can come to you and just even going to AA and then getting up and expressing some of the shit you've been through and having a room of people look at you, and this is stuff that you think this is the worst shit ever. For them to look at you just like, is that it?
exactly. I did do AA in the beginning. It wasn't for me. Let's just say that. I think people really need to just try everything that's available to them and see what works. See what sticks, see what feels true to you. But that was the first time when I went to AA post-detox that I had ever heard men talk in that way. My mind was blown. I was like, wow, here's this rapscallion, guy who's looks really, they've got the tats and they've got the this and they're getting up and they're just putting their stuff out there. And I was back to you, dude. I just had so much respect for these guys that were getting up and sharing these really raw parts of themselves.
Mm.
And yeah, it was the first time I'd seen that. And there's just such freedom in being able to do that, isn't there, don't you think?
Mm. And having the ability to share your weaknesses, supposedly, that just becomes a strength.
Yeah.
And it shows, yeah, true courage and power within yourself. Because this, I mean, for me to be open and honest about my journey was just encouraged there in rehab, just like, just be open and honest about your experiences. It's like, okay. And then you start doing it, you get comfortable with it. And
then
you have, like, I have people who commend me on that, and I don't think much of it because it's just like, well, this is just what I went through. I mean, you know, I'm just one person, but it does help to, yeah, be open about, because, yeah, then it might reach someone who thinks they may have experienced something similar, and then they go, oh, this person experiences, oh, it's not as bad as I'm making it out in here.
Massive, massive. But I think also it's like you've held on to this for so long yourself, and the heaviness of that, the shame of that, thinking that, you know, and I see this with my clients all the time, that like kind of they think they're the only one, or they think there's just a few people out there like them. And so we're sort of hiding under this thing of like, nobody see, don't anybody see. And then when you can kind of go, well, fuck it, everybody see, you know, like, I don't care anymore. I'm just, this is who I am.
Yeah.
This is part of my story. And that is so liberating. I don't want to use the word empowering because I just think it's a bit cliche and overused, but it's just freeing.
Mm.
Like, you are owning your story. You're not letting it own you anymore.
Mm.
And to just go, here I am, warts and all. It's kind of like nothing can hurt you after that. I mean, it can, but it's really, yeah, there's something so powerful in that. And I did it on national TV.
Lovely.
I did it
We're
on
going
national.
Big.
It was slowly, yeah. Let's go straight in at the deep end. I did it on national TV on the 7:30 report, and it was just, it was so terrifying to have that out there. And I contacted the people that I work with, and I still do some work with, as a consultant. And I said to them, look, this show's going out. And I was working for you at the time. And I, you know, when I said I was going into hospital and I was very cagey about what that was, that's what that was. I was going into inpatient detox, and it's going to come out, you know, it's on national TV, and I just want to let you know in case there's any detrimental impact on the business, like with clients and things like that. And they were like, oh, no, fine. But that was really the first time I'd come out en masse. Most people close to me knew about it. I think I was about 18 months sober at that point. And it was, I just didn't know what the response was going to be. And I thought as well, am I ever going to work again? Like, will I get, you know, she's it was quite the opposite, actually. It was really well received, and it was just such a turning point for me in the power of sharing your human fallibility. You know, because this is the thing, like, we're all struggling.
Yeah.
Everyone. It doesn't matter how much money you've got. It doesn't matter how successful you are. It doesn't matter how happy your relationship is. You know, like, everyone, this is an inherent part of the human experience. And the more we kind of just get real about that and go, yep, you've got mental health. Yep, you've got, you know, friggin' neurodiversity. You've got addiction. You've got, you know, it's like, let's just be real about the fact that this stuff touches everybody.
Yeah.
And stop pretending that it's some kind of failing, weakness, moral flaw, you know. It's something that lots and lots of people go through.
Yeah, it's not as rare as you make out that you think it is. And, yeah, just the willingness to be open and sharing, yeah, some difficult parts about yourself. That's where, you know, deep bonding relationships form is usually not really on the surface level shit, which maybe at times, I mean, like for male relationships, I guess in my experience with mates, that's what a lot of it was. And you never really went, you never really dug beneath the surface with a lot of your mates because, again, weakness, no, we've got to be showing up this way. But as I've been exploring, I guess, was like a men's group last year, well, yeah, like, I guess men, like you were probably describing, we've probably seen in AA, just, you know, these, because it was like a workout group, so these big fucking tough men, tattoos, whatever, you know, but then being completely open and sharing all the shit that they're going through, the struggles they have, and a bunch of men around them sitting there holding space, as they say, and, like, you know, showing support for the guy to just be able to express, I guess, his authentic self and just what he's going through. And I think, I mean, and to toss back to, I guess, Intoxicated, which is the alcohol-free social tribe that you've founded. I mean, there's that saying that the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
And that certainly can be something of a struggle for a lot of people wishing to, if it is, get sober or change their relationship with alcohol, is then evidently a lot of their relationships with people change if the core of it is them all getting together and getting on the piss. So having something like this where, well, that's not the, no one's drinking. So how did that come about, just from, I guess, was that just another idea to start as well?
Yeah, it was basically because it was what I needed. In all honesty.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything where I was like, let's start something, you know, that's going to turn into a big thing. It was just, I need some mates that don't drink.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's nothing out there. And I don't want to go to recovery groups and that be my social thing. Because at that stage I was past the early bit.
Yeah.
I think I was, when I started it, I was probably about 12 months, something like that. And basically what I found when I was doing AA, I briefly had a sponsor for about 5 seconds, and I said to her, you know, what do people do socially? And she said to me, oh, there's a really good meeting on Saturday night at New Farm, and, you know, da-da-da. And I just thought, nah, I'm not, that is not my social life.
Yeah.
Fuck that. Like, no, I might. But the other thing was, Will, is that, you know, like we've spoken about, there's a lot of heaviness in this. And I am a naturally fun, playful kind of person. And I was just like, it can't all be work. All be heavy. Like, there's a lot of heaviness in this. We need, or I need, some time out from frigging looking at my issues or, you know, delving into childhood trauma or whatever. I need some time out from this. I need to be able to have a laugh.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this is heavy duty, and I need to maybe get some sense of escape just from not thinking about the sober stuff all the time. Yeah. And, so that's why I started it. And it just quickly grew, and then certainly after the 7:30 report went out, that was when it really did start taking off a lot more, and I opened up more groups. And it really is just for people who, you don't have to be in recovery, you don't have to be sober 24/7. It's anyone who wants to socialize without booze for any reason. We don't ask you. You're not showing up as, hey, I'm someone who's got a drinking problem. We have people coming who, you know, just don't like drinking, have never been drinkers.
Yeah.
Because then they're in the same boat. What do they do?
Yeah. I think it's good to just not bring the focus to, all right, well, we're not drinking. It's bringing the focus to, we're meeting together, you know, if it's for activities, if it's for just something, it's for something else outside of that. Because it's always just, if it's the focus, the focal point is, oh, well, I'm not drinking, it's a purpose. It's just like, well, that's fine, but like, focus on what it is, you're doing together, and actually, meeting up with people in a social setting, and then having conversations or having, like, doing things together where there is no alcohol involved, and it might take you back to a time before you started drinking. Like if it was in your teenage years, like for me, like there was a time, where any sort of social interaction, I always had to be liquored up at some point. It was just, I couldn't go without it.
Yeah.
And
because you know that social anxiety is highly prevalent in people that have a problematic relationship with alcohol.
Mm. Yeah, I learned that I had it when I started going out sober and then experiencing these feelings and things, and I was just like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
I haven't experienced this before.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, because you were drunk the rest of the time numbing it out. Mm. So, and then, then you just think, oh, is it going to be like this all the time? And then like, oh, socializing is becoming more difficult. And I think what's worked for me was, I guess a big part for me was like, because I like health and fitness. So I like going to the gym. I used to go to the gym a lot on my own, but then now I'm going to group fitness gyms. So we work out in the morning and then we go for coffee afterwards. It's a completely different dynamic. And then I'm with people, some of them drink, a lot of them aren't that interested in drinking really. I mean, they drink if they want to. It's that thing of just like, well, I'll have a drink if I feel like it, but
these unicorns.
I can't relate.
What? I remember the first time intoxicated someone turned up, and he was in his 20s, and he was like, oh yeah, I've never really liked drinking. I mean, I do drink sometimes, but I'll just have one. What? How does that work? Yeah. I don't get it.
There was this clip I saw on TikTok. I think I posted it on Instagram, and this guy was talking about going out to, I think he was an alcoholic, going out for an anniversary dinner with his wife, and they'd have the dinner, have the dessert, check would come, they're walking back to the hotel, and she stops him and goes, oh, I forgot to have a cocktail for our anniversary. And he just looked at her just like, that's the equivalent of me going to dinner for 2 hours and forgetting to order dinner.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a good analogy, yeah.
Absolutely. I have heard that somewhere. But it is, I think when you're in it as well, you're constantly thinking about how you can get more, aren't you?
Mm.
You're like, oh, shit, okay, well, if we go home, then there's that stuff that I've got in the back of the fridge that, you know, that it's constantly thinking, like, how can I get more without it being obvious?
Mm. Yeah, trying to hide it.
Like noticing that, you know, you've already knocked off yours and that the other person, you know, in the round is still sipping on theirs you're like, oh, hurry up, will you?
Mm. Yeah, but it's a good thing to, I think, like, I mean, especially with the prevalence of more non-alcoholic options, which certainly certainly never crossed my mind when I was drinking to partake in that. And I've heard of people when they're out, if they are drinking, they like mix and match. So it's like they have a drink, but then they have a non-alcoholic drink in between. Mm. I mean, like I had a Brazilian housemate. He used to, and I'd never seen anyone do it. Maybe that just speaks for being Australian. Like he'd have a drink and then have a glass of water. I never saw anyone do that.
Yeah.
So that was eye-opening for me. But yeah, so I guess like with the intoxicated, so is it Australia-wide or is it broadening to Australia-wide? And
we've been in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne now for a few years, and I've just opened groups. We haven't got any events up yet in on the Gold Coast, Adelaide and Perth.
Mm.
So really with it, we do all sorts of different things. It depends what hosts want to hold. But like you're talking about, Will, it's about being in those situations, like going out to dinner, like going camping, these situations where we've all usually used alcohol.
Yeah.
Because how do you learn and how do you start embedding new neural pathways unless you've got different information to override what has always been there. Mm. And also the social anxiety. So one thing that I definitely noticed with people with intoxicated is that, you know, people are always socially anxious.
Mm.
Socializing without booze. And that's, you know, usually they're in the mix for the first 5 or 10 minutes and then people relax into it.
Mm.
Because everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah.
And so it just gives people the opportunity to connect with others, start recognizing that, like, hey, I can actually meet other normal people that don't drink. Mm. They're not necessarily, you know, I think that's the thing when you go to something like AA, and this is a generalization, is that for some people it can feel alienating because they're like, I'm not like those people.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, because those people might be, I don't know, the bikey or the whatever it is. And with Untoxicated, we're not a recovery group, so it's comparing, you know, apples and oranges. But the point being is that people can go along, they can see other people like them, they can learn to skills to be able to socialize without alcohol. Mm. They can learn to be in new environments without it as well, which, you know, for me personally, I'd never been out to dinner and not been drinking.
Mm.
Very, very rarely.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't bother going.
Mm.
Like, the thought of me going to something, driving, and then coming home would be like, well, what's the point? Why would I go?
Yeah.
If I go and drink.
Yeah.
And so never really having been exposed to those environments, or certainly never being exposed to those environments and going, actually relax into it. Let's actually connect with people, have a laugh, rather than white knuckling the whole time going, oh, I can't wait till we can leave so I can go home and have a few drinks.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's also hopefully providing people with some of that fun and playfulness and, you know, some of the good stuff to counterbalance the heavier stuff.
To provide a place for people to be comfortable to be themselves, where they don't need to check out with booze or liquor up to then, oh, well, now this is me relaxed and fine. And a lot of it, yeah, like it's just, I guess, like an icebreaker breaking the ice. And then once you pass that, then you kind of ride into it. And then you get to the end of the night and you just think, what was I worried about?
Yeah. Like, and it's so interesting you say that, actually, because, like, remember when you were a kid and you'd be in an environment, it might be a birthday party or it might be your parents know someone else and you've been taken to their house and you don't know any of the kids, or you don't know, you might know one or two.
Mm.
And you're all like, oh. But within about 10 minutes, you're all running off, you're all best mates, and it's all, you know, it's all forgotten about, and you have a great time. That's what socializing without alcohol as an adult can be like when you're not used to it.
Mm.
It's like being as you were as a child, where you're like, oh God, what if nobody likes me? And oh no, and all the stories that we're telling ourselves. And then within 10 minutes, going, oh, it's all right. Actually, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nothing to be alarmed about. And it's always, I think, to look at it a grand scheme of things, to, if I'm feeling this way, surely there's someone else here probably feeling the same way as well, you know? I mean, yeah, like, it'd be a whole bunch of people, especially if it's, yeah, you're all coming together, and if some people have issues with drinking or just trying out, going out without drinking and coming into an environment, yeah, then those things that do come up, and yeah, they certainly do for me still, because yeah, there's times it's just like, oh, I don't know, if I get invited to something, it's like, oh, I don't know if I'll know anyone there, and this is like, oh, I'll do it. I could easily just stay home. Because, I don't know, there was like a time maybe I thought I was more extroverted, but I guess maybe that was just the liquor, if that just made me more extroverted and interested. But then, yeah, at times I certainly feel a lot more introverted now, where there'll come a point where I'm just like, I'm socialized out, I'm out, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think that's something that a lot of people notice when they stop drinking. Mm. I mean, I am an extrovert, but I do notice, like, 2-3 hours.
Mm.
I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all stuff, yeah, you can learn more about yourself, because the person you are when you're drinking isn't you. It's just this other alternative creation that comes out. And sometimes it's happy, it's sad, it's ugly, it's all different things. I mean, that was in my experience. So it's a good time, yeah, that you quit drinking to, yeah, really learn about yourself and being comfortable with who you are. And then, yeah, if this is all right, if I am more this way, then that shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
Just lean into it.
Exactly. 100%. I think that's where you start getting into that self-acceptance of like, well, this is who I am, you know, and there's no point trying to fight whether I'm naturally an extrovert, naturally an introvert. If I'm someone who doesn't like being in crowded places, if I'm someone who does actually like to spend quite a lot of time by myself, you know, or whatever it might be for you, I think taking the alcohol out of the mix allows you the ability to be able to see that. And it allows you the ability to be able to start connecting back to yourself and really learning to trust yourself, like you said earlier, but also learning to have your own back.
Yeah.
You know, rather than keep throwing yourself under a fucking bus.
Yeah.
And that is where to get all woo is kind of like the reparenting piece. It's the where you are starting to look after yourself, and looking after yourself isn't always doing the things that we want to do. You know, the things we might want to do is going out and getting fucked up, but we're kind of like the parent who's like, okay, come on.
Maybe not.
Is that really going to be a good idea, Faye? You know, is calling your ex for a hookup really going to be a good idea, Faye? Sober or otherwise?
Yeah.
So it is about actually as well having that space between the thought and the action. Which I think when you're drinking, you don't have.
Yeah.
You're just in constant, constantly reactive.
Yeah.
And taking the alcohol out gives you the space to see there is that opportunity to do things differently, to respond differently than you historically would have.
Yeah.
And then start going, okay, well, really, is this a bit of a good idea? And knowing you're going to fuck up. You're still going to fuck up. My life has not been, since I stopped drinking, has not been all good choices.
Yeah.
You know, I've fucked up plenty.
Yeah.
But it's...
unavoidable in life.
What can you do?
Mm-hmm.
What can you do?
Yeah. But in saying that, like, I've never met anybody who quit drinking and told me their life got worse, really.
Yeah.
So... well, thank you for coming on today, Faye.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been a lovely chat.
Thanks for having me, Will.
Covered a lot there. I'll just leave you with one last question. What's the best piece of advice you've received?
Oh, God, that's a really difficult one. Do you mean in the context of drinking?
Could be in the context of anything. In the life of Faye, the fabulous, fantabulous, fantastic the
fabulous,
Faye.
Fantabulous Faye. Oh, okay. The best piece of advice that I've received probably, I would say, has been, and it might be a bit of a cliche, but it is, I think, the be yourself because everybody else is taken.
Yeah. Yeah, Ash Butters, we interviewed, she said that same thing too.
Oh, did she? Yeah. Oh, no, can I take it back? I've got to find another one. I don't want one that everyone else has had because that one's already been taken. But I think it is about that being yourself, being unapologetically you. Okay, here's another one. We can do hard things.
Yeah. We can do hard things.
We can do hard things.
Well, being unapologetically you is another one that another guest said.
Oh, so, God, well. For God's sake.
It goes to show, oh, it's not only me. No, it's very common, you know, like all these things, it's all very common, like all these ideas, yeah, like because they work. It's just like, yeah, be yourself. Yeah, it's a good thing. Be unapologetically you. Do the hard things.
Well, something that I do think is really a really good piece of advice is that I think for a lot of us, you know, as humans, the survival of the species has been around avoidance of pain. It's been around survival and to run from the bear, run from the tribe with the spears, run from, you know, avoid starving to death, all of these things. That's how we've survived. And so I think we shy away from any level of discomfort where we can. I think really one of the keys is actively leaning in. Actively leaning into things that make you feel uncomfortable. If there's one thing you do for yourself, make it be that. Because whether that's reaching for help, whether it's going for therapy, whether it's doing a bloody ice bath, whether it's going and doing the social thing that you're scared about doing, whether it's asking that girl out, that, you know, whatever it might be. Because when you do the uncomfortable thing and you realize that it doesn't kill you, that you get through one way or the other, you then start avoiding things as much, and you start learning that inner resilience, which is like, no matter what life throws at me, I'm going to handle it. I'm going to handle it. It might not be what I want. It might be hard. It might be really fucking painful, but it could be great. And whatever it is, I'm going to be okay. Yeah, I think that's probably the key learning for me out of this whole experience.
Would you be annoyed if someone else already said that? No, they haven't. They haven't. That was because that was really great. That was a really great ending. Thank you for that, Faye. That was awesome.
My pleasure.
Well, this has been the Last Rings podcast. I'm Will Hitchens, and we'll see you in the next one.
Thanks, Will.